for July 28th, 2008, it's the Lullabot Podcast.
Lullabot Podcast.
It's episode 61 of the Lullabot Drupal Podcast. We get together every few weeks, talk about Drupal, and then you can download it, and we call it a podcast.
It's a system that works.
It's, you know, it's a thing. It's RSS. And RSS. Well, I'm going to...
You know, RSS
there you go,
is the foundation of web APIs.
It is. It is. And today on the podcast, I was trying to make that connection myself. And today on the podcast, we're going to be talking about APIs. We're going to be talking about mashups in particular and Drupal. Drupal, is Drupal the ultra mega mashup machine that you've been looking for?
Corey Doc wants to know.
And so, so we're going to talk about mashups and generally sort of what is the technology behind that and how that works on the podcast today. Yes. I'm Jeff Robbins, and I'm here with
Jeff Eaton,
as well as
James Walker
and
John Van Dyke.
John Van Dyke, the latest addition to the Lullabot team. You may know John Van Dyke from such books as Pro Drupal Development.
And Pro Drupal Development 2nd Edition.
Yes, particularly the 2nd Edition, which John is currently banging against his head.
What's banging the drafts against my head?
How's it going?
Oh, it's done.
It's done?
It is done. It's going to production. I think it's end of this week, beginning of next week.
So when will people be able to get that into their hot little hands?
Well, I don't know, but last time with the first edition, we were pleasantly surprised at how fast it turned around from when we were done with it to when it was actually on the shelves. So soon.
Right on.
What are the new topics that are covered in the second edition?
Well, the second edition is really adds a chapter on actions, specifically how they work, what they do. And for the rest of it, it's pretty much new and improved. I think the first edition was something like 390 pages before the index, and this one is like 600 and something.
Holy smokes!
I was verbose.
Wow! So it's not just a revision. I mean, it's complete.
It's like revised and expanded.
Wow!
Awesome.
That's cool.
Goodness. And so this one aims at Drupal 6, whereas the last one was aiming at Drupal 5.
Exactly. Yeah, we cover the new, you know, new theming stuff, batch API, all the other new and great stuff that Drupal 6 has in it.
And so that's why you're included the actions stuff, right? Because actions are now, but it's, are they called actions in core now? It's triggers, right?
Well, it's sort of a two-headed beast. There's actions.inc, but there's actually trigger module. So I think people generally call them actions, but the interface calls them triggers.
Oh, that's always fun. I love it when Drupal does that. We're going to call them paths, but in the interface, we'll call them URLs. We'll call them filters, but in the interface, we'll call them...
monkeys.
But that's actually a big push. That whole end of things is something that's being worked on a lot in Drupal right now, is sort of the user interface end of things. And I always say that, like, Drupal 5 got this sort of, like, got to a tipping point where it really expanded. I mean, I would say that most of the Drupal sites that are out there right now are Drupal 5 sites. And so I find my
statistics bear this out.
Yeah, well, in fact, Drupal.org is still a Drupal 5 site, which is probably a podcast in and of itself.
A touchy topic.
Yes. And so, you know, I find myself sort of using Drupal 5 sites and using Drupal 6 sites, and I'm always sort of really pleasantly impressed with the changing of the wording of things like user permissions now, as opposed to what were they called before?
Access permissions.
Access control. It wasn't even called permissions before. And so permissions seems to make a lot more sense to me. So that's good stuff. So let's hit up some news. I think the biggest news item for us right now at Lullabot is Angie Byron got a Google O'Reilly Open Source Award. That for us, that was last night. For those of you listening, exactly when this podcast comes out, it'll be a few days ago or whatever. But
pretty awesome news.
Yeah, really good stuff. She got an award. Her award was Best Contributor for her work on Drupal.
And it's actually pretty seeing the Drupal.org thread as like every registered user on Drupal.org chimes in and says, "Oh, that's awesome. Angie helped me once."
Totally.
Yeah, we joke a lot about internally at Lullabot about sort of, you know, Angie's through the roof karma levels and things like that. But I mean, it's really nice for her to be acknowledged externally like this. That, you know, and yeah, the response sort of shows exactly why. I mean, she's, you know, she runs Summer of Code. She, you know, ran the Google highly open participation thing. She's in everybody's issue queue all the time and just really, you know, if it's at all Drupal related or can help the Drupal community, she's there. And so it's, yeah, I don't know. I feel super proud. Yeah. Yeah. She's amazing.
And super friendly.
Yeah. Super friendly.
So next time you see Angie, give her a hug and, and, yeah, so this is great. And so you can, let's see if we can see, we can go through this URL. So http://, you know that part, code.google.com/open-source/osa-hall-of-fame.html. And we'll try and put that in the, podcast notes. And if we don't get to it, you can get to it. Please participate. Yeah, we love it when
consider it an open podcast.
Yes, but we love it when people come along and take notes of on the podcast and put them up in the comments with the links and stuff like that, because sometimes it's all we can do to get a podcast done, and it's always wonderful to have some help. So other announcements, CCK and Views.
Heck yeah. I don't think we got a chance to mention that on the last podcast. It's the release candidates of both CCK and Views are out, and I believe CCK has actually gone through two release candidates. They're basically to the point where I'd feel comfortable actually building a site with those two and saying, yeah, I'm not just, you know, riding on the bleeding edge. These are tools that are, you know, ready to make stuff with.
Yeah. Yeah, that's exciting. I mean, it feels like there was a real, I mean, there was sort of a time of frustration when, and we did a podcast somewhat about this, about like, should you start building websites with Drupal 6? You know, it was hard to recommend it to people, when Views and CCK weren't quite there yet. And now they're there. So, at least there are release candidates, and people should download it and start using it. And if there are little last-minute bugs, please contribute, even if you're just contributing by saying, I found a bug.
And the exciting thing on both of those is that they're not just direct ports of the Drupal 5 versions. There's actually new capabilities and new features that were whole things that weren't possible in previous versions, which is actually why there were such delays between the Drupal 5 and 6 versions. So for those that haven't been following the development, there's a lot of awesome and fun surprises and new capabilities in store.
Yeah. Also, if you haven't seen Views 2 yet, you're in for a treat.
Oh, yeah.
Well, just Drupal 6 in general is really, really fun to work with. I like it a lot. In fact, I did a Drupal 5 theme recently, and I actually just did it in Drupal 6 first and then backported it because it was easier, better to do in Drupal 6. So, yeah. So, big announcement.
So speaking of that Drupal theme you were working on.
Well, the big announcement is Lullabot is doing what we're calling a big event, a big thing. We've got a big seminar coming up in New Orleans in December that we've been planning, and it's called Do It with Drupal. And it's a, you know, basically sort of a, the workshop work that we've been doing, there's always this kinds of stuff that, you know, we want to do with the workshops. And this is going to be, I don't know, sort of like an all-star, big, giant Drupal learning expo experience.
With singing and dancing.
It's going to be... It's
show gonna, tunes. Yeah, and a soundtrack. Yeah, yeah, just to sort of expand on that, there's, you know, we've been doing our Drupal intensive workshop for a while and talking about, for a long time, how we can sort of further meet that sort of audience. So the audience being people who have sort of heard of Drupal, maybe have tinkered around with it, but are really kind of stuck at the starting line, not sure, you know, how to best approach a project, if Drupal's even really the right answer, what it's capable of, how to even sort of get started. And so, yeah, we've been talking about doing a bigger event for a long time. And yeah, I am super stoked that we're actually, it's actually happening. It's real.
And I think one of the other groups that could really benefit from something like this that we're sort of trying to target is people who maybe are working inside of an organization that's, you know, either looking at Drupal or has decided to go with Drupal, and maybe even there are a couple of, you know, developers or whatever in-house, but as somebody who's like organizing a team like that or whatever, trying to understand, you know, what the Drupal landscape is and what are the pieces that I'm working with that my team is going to be building things on, and how do I understand its capabilities and, you know, recognize the pitfalls before we hit them. Those kinds of questions that there isn't necessarily an opportunity to dive too deep into in the really hands-on focus of the workshop. There's an opportunity to explore some of those things at the at this seminar that I think will be really valuable.
Yeah, and so
this isn't like a hardcore, I'm going to recompile my PHP with a C extension to make Drupal run faster kind of.
It's sort of less focused on the code, maybe, than yeah, certainly. And so, but you can, like, we've already got some speakers already on deck, and we're working on more. But, like, so Earl Miles is going to be there, and so people can come learn about views and panels from the guy that wrote it, which is always really great. I mean, you know, we do our workshops and we sort of talk about the, well, I think he was kind of thinking this when he put it here and stuff. And you can talk to Earl about that stuff. And likewise, we've got Moshe Weitzman, who's going to come and talk about organic groups stuff. Ryan Srama, is, I believe how you pronounce his last name, is going to come and talk about UberCart. Karen Stevenson will be there talking about CCK. I mean, these are, you know, all the people that actually, you know, did most of the work on these modules. So it's really, really awesome stuff. And we'll have more to announce about it moving forward. You can go to doitwithdrupal.com and find out information as it's coming together. And registration will open in a few weeks. Yeah. So we're really excited about it. We've been really itching to do a big event like this for a while now, and we're excited. So
yeah, it's going to be fun too. Did you mention that?
Yeah, fun, guaranteed, yeah, fun. A little bit.
We're going to have lots of fun.
Yeah.
There may be novelty modules written.
Yeah. Yep. And also, John Van Dyke will be presenting. So always a treat. Right, John?
Yeah, and what will I be presenting, Jeff?
We'll figure it out. John, you know, you could work on, you could, you know, talk about the early stages of CCK.
Yeah.
Well, James, that's you.
Right? Well, yeah, I was gonna start with that story, but I figured, you know, we've got other things to.
That's right.
But for those of you who don't know, yeah, John was actually sort of one of the two first architects of CCK, and yeah, definitely falls in the old school Drupal developer category. So
he drew a lot of diagrams on napkins in Belgian bars, I think.
that's how all the really good modules start, right?
Yeah. It all happens in a dingy basement in Belgium.
It really all does when it comes right down to it. Yep. So let's talk about mashups and APIs and all that sort of stuff. So what is a mashup?
Well, it's funny that you should ask. A mashup is a particular application of like Web 2.0 APIs. Yahoo Pipes, which is something that we were talking about earlier, is a great example of that. It's a tool that basically lets you go around to all these sites like Flickr or Delicious or whatever that provide access to their data, or even sites that just generate RSS feeds and stuff like that, and just pipe that information through different rules and spit it out in, you know, formatted and filtered, you know, presentations that, you know, match the criteria that you want. That's a really classic example of what's termed a mashup, because the Yahoo Pipes website doesn't really provide a lot of standalone functionality. It doesn't provide a lot of any content on its own. Its whole job is to take these pools of information that are out there on the larger internet and just pull them together and combine them effectively so that the value of the sum is greater than that of its part, or, you know, that whole line.
Yeah, I think it's all about reusing, you know, existing applications and more often, you know, existing data sources, right? Where you've got, you know, there's all these sites on the internet that have, you know, sites like Flickr that has, you know, I don't know, a bazillion photos and, you know, places where, you know, people's blogs and things where they're talking about things. People are storing, you know, all kinds of bits of information all over the internet. And by having having APIs and having ways to get at that data, programmatically, you know, from other websites and from other tools, you can reuse that and sort of mix and mash them into interesting new applications or sites or ideas or whatever.
It's actually interesting because quite a few years back, actually, a friend of mine was hired to develop this custom application for a client of his, and its only job was to go out and do searches on Google and Drupal and a bunch of other like specialized search engines and actually skim through the raw HTML that got spit back, parse it to pull out useful results and combine them into just sort of a meta search engine.
Screen scraping.
Exactly. That's like the very, very distant, you know, single cell organism ancestors of this web API and mashup concept. The difference is today in the crazy Web 2.0 world where, you know, exchanging information like this is sort of a baseline assumption of how things should work. Instead of just telling people, okay, you know, scrape the raw HTML and do what you will with it, there's actually, you know, special URLs you can hit on these different sites that will return data properly formatted with the idea that they'll be used in other applications sort of already baked in so that you don't have to do all that heavy lifting. And it's all built with that idea of different things being combined together.
So this is all pretty obtuse and abstract. You've got these big pools of data, you know, and you've got APIs over here and you've got Web 2.0 over there. What is that actually, like, what can you do with that? Like, what's a practical example of that?
Other than hand-waving and talking about the semantic web?
Yeah, but what are you actually going to do with it?
There are lots of answers to this. Fine answers. An example would be using, say, Google Maps and its ability to return, like, a map with different spots plotted on that map when you feed it location information. One example, I think a site that somebody pulled together was take Flickr photos that have been tagged with where they were taken and put them on a Google map so that you can look at it and say, oh, here's my hometown. Have people on Flickr taken photos of my hometown? And you can see all the spots in a city that, you know, people posted photos of. That's a real basic idea.
So it starts to use the web in the way that the web was sort of, you know, they don't call it the World Wide Webs, you know, it's one entity, and we're starting to move towards this sort of global supercomputer kind of thing where the websites can all talk to each other using these APIs, right?
That's the idea.
Yeah, back before sort of the Web 2.0 buzzword started to get a little passe, I took part in a couple panels and talks and things talking about Web 2.0 and sort of the best kind of single encapsulation of it I ever heard was that the 2.0 was really about the two-way web, and it's the idea of this sort of interconnection, and the whole kind of web concept was initially that this, you know, it would all be interconnected and sort of interrelated, right? Which hypertext and linking sort of gets, but you know, what we're seeing now is sort of a much deeper sort of, you know, moving around of content and information, passing things back and forth between sites and stuff like that.
So by definition, you need a content management system because it's about reformatting the content. And if you just had an static HTML, you can't really reformat that. Which to some extent, I mean, that kind of gets into the micro formats thing that maybe we could mention a little bit later. But for the most part, when you're talking about these different APIs, you're talking about reformatting the content in different ways. And so what are the different ways that the data is actually formatted? What language are the APIs speaking when they speak to each other? And,
we've got a whole alphabet soup.
Well, let's run them down.
The next step up from that sort of screen scraping HTML on a website thing is using RSS feeds and Atom feeds, which are a lot like RSS, just formatted slightly differently. It's a format just specifically designed to encapsulate the idea of a post or piece of news or piece of content on a website in a format where an external program could pull it down and display it, like in a news reader or something like that. There's lots and lots of RSS readers out there that like to subscribe to a blog and read the contents of it without even firing up your web browser. And actually, Drupal has an RSS aggregator module built in so that a Drupal site can pull in RSS feeds from another location and display them as content on the website. That's like the baseline beginnings of Web 2.0 interaction, because you can take content from another website, content from a third website, and roll them together and present them as sort of a big stream of news without manually going in and copying and pasting content and stuff like that.
It says something that this is part of Drupal core, right? This ability of Drupal to read content from other RSS feeds on the internet. I mean, it's sort
of the fact that it's part of Drupal core and has been, I mean, since like 1972.
It read it through punch cards back then. That's
totally. Yeah, no, but I mean, certainly when I first got involved in Drupal, it was one of the most exciting things was some of the, you know, at the time, very sort of experimental, sort of forward thinking, you know, kind of things that were incorporated and were sort of part of the community, is what was the community was interested in, and therefore what the software, you know, did. Now sort of 6-7 years later, it's, you know, it's much more commonplace, and Drupal's sort of already ahead of that curve, which, you know, is part of why we're talking about it today.
So what are the other ways? I mean, I hear about soap. What is soap? And
yeah, it's how you keep from being stinky.
And do people really care?
Yeah. So, well, I mean, it all kind of, and just to sort of build on what Jeff was saying, it all sort of starts with this idea of having, you know, a more structured sort of machine readable format of your content. And so the simplest is RSS. There are a bunch of other, sort of layers that have built on top that use, you know, various XML based formats for the way they actually exchange data back and forth. But there's things like SOAP and XML RPC, which are basically, you know, taking an XML format for, you know, exchanging information or data. And then SOAP and XML RPC actually define, you know, ways to call a function on another server. Rather than just requesting a single file that's, you know, say an RSS feed of the latest 10 blog posts, you can actually say, you know, now post a new blog post, right? Or, you know, add some categories to a blog post or something like that. And so you can start to, you know, and that's where the sort of the API really gets, you know, idea gets fully realized, where, because you're actually programmatically interacting with other sites.
Another really interesting reading what's there, instead of just reading what's there on the feed, you can actually make a special request and say, hey, I want this kind of information.
So an RSS feed is sort of a published kind of a thing. I mean, tends to be, right? So you get the 20 latest things, and you can go and get those 20 latest things for the most part.
Yeah.
But you can't say, I don't know, a much more complex request would be, show me all of the posts by this person, you know, arbitrarily show me, you know, all of the posts by this person between this date and this date.
Well, I mean, to sort of bring it home, I mean, an actual example is, say, the Flickr APIs. Flickr actually has different URLs that you can hit on their API server that let you make requests like, show me photos by a particular user tagged with a particular term. And they'll send you back an XML document that just has information on what photos they have stored on their server, like the URL that a user could actually click on to go to that photos page, what's the actual JPEG URL, who posted it, when it was posted, what the description of it is, just sort of all of that data in a format that's easy for a computer to parse and read and format and manipulate, as opposed to the formatted Flickr page that you would see if you went there in your web browser. And the idea is, by making requests like that, you could easily do something like, say, you know, in the context of Drupal, if you tagged a given post with particular keywords, you could write a module that automatically pulls in Flickr pictures that have matching keywords that you posted, or something like that. That's an example of like how you would leverage that kind of stuff. A really advanced example of it, and this is like how it goes beyond just publishing or pulling information back, Amazon.com has e-commerce APIs that let people not just pull up product information, but even maintain an Amazon shopping cart via your site. So, for example, if you were building a simple, say, you know, topical site about, say, entomology or something like that, you could also have a little library in your, you know, website that lists a bunch of books that people might find interesting, and you could have a click to add this to a cart button on there that behind the scenes is actually just making requests to Amazon's API servers, telling Amazon, okay, fire up a cart for me, put this into the cart, here's the session of the user that's maintaining this, and then when somebody actually on your site hits checkout, that's when they would finally be taken to the Amazon.com website to complete their order. But you know, up to that point, they would still just be interacting with your site, and your site would be using web APIs in the background to store all the information and maintain it on Amazon.com. Mm. Did that make any sense?
Yeah, yeah. And so are we talking exclusively about SOAP, or are there other APIs? And incidentally, what does SOAP stand for?
Simple Object Access Protocol, I think.
Yep.
Yeah.
John saves the day.
Which is sort of ironic, because SOAP is probably the most complicated protocol.
My understanding is that a lot of people don't – I'm trying to remember who it was that posted their APIs in a bunch of different formats, and they were saying that although everyone was asking for SOAP, they found it was used very, very little, because a lot of the other protocols are a lot –
One of the biggest benefits for SOAP is that a lot of .NET technologies automatically leverage SOAP really effectively. So, like, if you're building a Windows application in like the C# programming language or Visual Basic .NET, it's real easy to just call helper functions and say, "I've built up this object inside of my program. Wrap it up as a SOAP data packet, and I can fire it off over the web." There's a lot of baked in, you know, easy wins for .NET programmers. Outside of that community, it's not as popular, because there's a lot more overhead to it, and it's a lot more bulky just as a data format, just in part because of all the stuff that it supports to make those things easy.
The other one, XMLRPC, is kind of a simplified version of SOAP, and that's the one that Drupal supports natively. It's in Drupal core. And I think there's a is it services services API module or services module has support for SOAP.
Ah, interesting.
Yeah, services API is a hidden gem of the Drupal world. It doesn't actually obviously do anything if you're just the install a module and click around and see what it does type. But what it does is it provides those kinds of endpoints so that other sites can make web API requests against your Drupal site. And you can say, yes, make it possible for people to post nodes or to retrieve specific nodes or, you know, things like that via these different web API protocols.
Yeah, we had Scott Nelson, the original author of that module, on the podcast a while back. So people want to go back into the archive, they can find out more specifically about the services module. What is REST is another thing I see sort of in this same alphabet soup of things. Does REST stand for something, or is it?
It does. It does. Yeah, it stands for the representational state transfer. And I totally wasn't reading that off Wikipedia. But So REST is I mean, SOAP and XMLRPC are sort of one family of API styles, and the difference sort of can get tricky and trying to differentiate them. But essentially what you do in XMLRPC or SOAP is, you do something, you define a command by saying, you talk to sort of one endpoint on a server. So you make a connection to their site's XMLRPC and you say, I want to run this command. And it's method based, right? So you call a function and you get a response. So RPC stands for remote procedure call, right? So you're calling a function on another site. Whereas REST is all sort of location, and they call it noun based. So you're talking about a thing. So you're talking about mysite.com/users, and then you say what you want to get, or you say what you want to do to users. You want to get a user, or you want to add a new user, and things like that. So in REST, it all starts with the sort of the object or the noun that you want to work on. Whereas RPC, you start with what you want to do, and what you'll see is a lot of certainly larger sites will actually expose their APIs via both methods. They'll have a REST API and an XMLRPC API. In fact, the one that comes to my mind first is Last.fm, which is one of my personal favorite sites. Recently just relaunched their API with a bunch of new features and things. And basically their API is available both via a REST format as well as XMLRPC, and it's just sort of a different ways to approach the same sort of functionality.
The common split between them seems to be that lots of like desktop client applications that interact with websites tend to use XMLRPC APIs because conceptually it tends to be a better match for the way like a desktop application is programmed. I've got this website and I want to run a function on it and I get a response back. Whereas a lot of just pure mashup stuff, or simple like, I want to request this piece of information from this website and display it on my website. Those things tend to use REST APIs. It's just a better conceptual match for the whole URL-based way that the web tends to work.
Yeah. And it's a little more efficient, too, because like with XMLRPC or with SOAP, you're constantly putting things into XML, and on the other end, you're parsing them out of XML.
Right.
And
right.
I think that step is just skipped when you use REST.
Yeah, with
that's
REST,
a big difference.
Yeah, with REST, the nice thing is, for most cases, so particularly if you're just trying to retrieve data, with a REST API, you're just calling a specific URL, right? You're calling a specifically formatted URL that in the URL, right, all of the sort of parameters are just passed in via standard HTTP GET request parameters, generally. So you'll just say, give me this, at this URL, give me, and with these parameters, give me the result. And then, so yeah, it takes an extra step out where you just then have to parse the result, so what that server sends back.
The downside to that, of course, is if you're actually exchanging large quantities of information, REST isn't quite as good because it's geared towards those shorter requests, and that's where XML RPC can be handy. You know, gigantic file uploads and stuff like that tends not to be as happy with REST.
I'm going to toss another one in because this seems to be one that I've seen when I've looked at people, you know, websites that are exposing their APIs. They seem to also expose a JSON API sometimes.
Haha.
You want to talk about that? What is JSON and
JavaScript Serialized Object Notation. Don't you just love all these acronyms? They're so easy to remember and intuitive. JSON conceptually is a lot like SOAP or XML RPC. It's a machine-readable representation of like an actual program object, like an array full of data or a particular object with, you know, code on it or, you know, whatever. The idea is that it's this packet for exchanging information over the web, but in the case of JSON, it's geared towards the idea that JavaScript code will be making these requests and getting it back and then unpacking all that information in order to, say, update a website or, you know, change what widgets are enabled or repopulate a particular block on the page or something like that. It's how a lot of stuff like, say, Google Mail, the Gmail interface, exchanges its data with the server on the back end.
Which is
the cool thing with JSON is that instead of encoding stuff into like XML and then decoding it from XML, where you're not actually using XML anywhere in your programming, you're not programming in XML. The JSON approach actually encodes stuff in JavaScript itself. So when it comes back, it's really fast to parse that out.
Yeah.
Right. So this is for JavaScript. So you're basically speaking to the front end, right? You're speaking to the browser.
Yeah.
There's not an efficient way for instance a PHP application to read JSON.
Well,
you wouldn't want to do that. Or would you?
Well, so you're not going to want to try to parse JSON necessarily in PHP because it is geared towards, you know, serving data up to, you know, JavaScript thing. So generally sort of AJAX type functionality, right? You're going to use JSON as the data format for that. And Drupal has some built-in things for on the server side, you know, in your PHP code for actually generating that JSON format. Just sort of in that, you know, efficient parsing thing. One of the reasons that sort of the REST style approach is so popular with web services is because, you know, is sort of in a REST style request, you can give back sort of what the server responds with to the request doesn't have to be XML. So similarly, you know, sort of in the AJAX world, you know, a lot of people are not doing true AJAX, which is why in Drupal 6 we have the AHA framework instead of, you know, an AJAX format, is because a lot of times it's actually just easier to send back the format that's going to be used.
Let's define some of these. AJAX standing for asynchronous JavaScript and XML, and yes. AHA standing for asynchronous HTML and HTTP. No, the other way around. HTTP and HTML or something like that.
Right. Yeah.
There's something. So basically, instead of, you know, the implication of AJAX is that you're getting XML back from the server. And
yes.
What we're saying is actually XML is not very efficient to get back from the server. It's better to just send a chunk of HTML.
The basic difference between AJAX and AHA is with AJAX, the idea is that you've got JavaScript running on the client side that says, okay, give me this big bundle of data. I'm going to go do stuff with it. In AHA, you've got JavaScript running on the client side that says, okay, render some HTML for me and I'll stick it somewhere on the page.
It's just like cutting out that step. If you're doing really complex stuff, Java, Ajax is still used a lot. But if what you want is, say, I want to refresh the contents of a block on the page, usually AHA is just a lot lighter weight because it cuts out all of that client-side parsing of XML and building up HTML when you can just ask the server, give me the HTML. You can do it faster than I can.
And all of these APIs we're talking about are external APIs, right? I mean, there's the APIs within Drupal that we talk about,
yes.
You know, the hook system and stuff like that. But that's not really – we're talking about like server to server or server to browser kind of client stuff as opposed to the internal APIs on Drupal, right?
Definitely.
So who has these APIs? I mean, I think the first one – the first website that I was sort of familiar with as kind of opening up these kind of APIs was, for me, it was Flickr. I think, you know, who was kind of early on in this ability. It's like, oh, we've got your photos, but here you want to get, you know, thumbnail images or a square version or any of that. You could just like display them on your blog or whatever. Use, you know, you just kind of change around the code a little bit, or you'd get the little and maybe this is sort of that JSON in action. You'd get a little sidebar badge kind of thing that you could display, and basically you just type in the little different code in there saying I want square images and I want them to be 100 pixels square, and I want 8 of them, and I want them to show up on the sidebar, you know, of my blog, and you just stick the code in there, and bingo, you'd get your pictures. That was pretty cool stuff. And then Google is sort of famous for their APIs and how they tend to open up stuff like that. Who else are really sort of the prominent players in this realm?
Yahoo actually has a huge number of open APIs that can be used. It's easy to miss, but Yahoo like actually has a lot of properties like stock services and stuff like that, weather services, all of which expose these external APIs. So if you say, I've got a zip code, give me an XML data packet back describing what the weather is currently in that zip code, that's another one of those things that you can use. Similarly, you can fire off a stock symbol and get back a little data packet saying what that stock's price is right now or what its past performance is, and you can use that in a web app or, you know, a widget or whatever.
And this is the kind of stuff that in the past people really guarded closely, right? I mean, it was, you know, this is data that, for instance, Yahoo probably spent a lot of money to be able to have the current stock prices for all of the stock, you know, on the various exchanges, right? And in the past, you used to have to pay a lot of money to get access to those kind of APIs. And now... we've got people like Yahoo and Google that are kind of, well, Yahoo in particular with those kind of, that kind of data. I remember, you know, in the 90s, just trying to show like a little thing to show the weather because the client wanted to show the local weather on their webpage, you know, and it was just like a hassle. I had to, you know, pay $10 or some $10 a month or something like that to get the freaking weather on the webpage.
Like, yeah, it's you brought up the example of Flickr, and I think one of the things that Flickr wasn't the first, you know, web API, but Flickr certainly was very, very open in their APIs. Like once they launched their APIs, you could basically, and still today, you can do basically anything you can do on the Flickr website. You can do via their public APIs and therefore via another, you know, another website or a desktop tool. Yeah, I mean, there's dozens of, you know, applications for uploading photos to Flickr, and that's all made possible by the fact that their API is so open, and they don't have to, you know, they don't have to write all the clients. They, you know, provide an API and provide the hooks sort of into their system, and then the rest sort of happens magically.
And it's sort of a leap of faith, isn't it? I mean, because...
Well, I mean, it is, but it's also so, I mean, it, you know, there's some pretty strong motivation and good reasons to do it, right? And particularly, and I mean, one of the reasons you see things like Flickr you know, so quick to adopt it is because, you know, in all of these sort of user-generated models, right, Flickr's not actually creating all the content, right? They're providing the environment. And what they're doing by giving sort of full in-and-out privileges for your data, they're saying, you know, it's actually encouraging more people to use Flickr because they don't have to worry about, well, you know, if I upload, you know, if I upload all my travel photos to Flickr, what happens if I don't want to use Flickr anymore? What happens, you know, I mean, all my photos will be trapped in Flickr and I won't be able to get them back out. And by allowing people's data to sort of move more freely and allow them to really have more access to it and more control in and out, they can, you know, they're much more inclined to sort of use Flickr, right? The fact that, you know, you can use Flickr to host your photos so you don't have to worry about the disk space, but then still, you know, embed those photos in your personal blog, as you were saying before.
So the data doesn't feel locked up.
Yeah, it's very, very encouraging, yeah.
Another key part of that is, I mean, this idea that no matter how awesome your website is, people spend a lot more of their time on the web looking at other websites. And one of the big challenges, and this was something that like AOL hit in the mid-90s, they, because they weren't sort of an open web-based system at the time, they had to either be the best at everything a user could possibly want to do, or at least make it such a hassle to move to other services that people still wanted to stay. And on the web, that barrier for moving to a different service basically just becomes, how much of a pain is it to get off my data? When tying in with all of these other external web services, the idea is that you can focus on being good, really, really good at what you want to do with your website, and then leverage other services for what they're really good at. Like, if you want to do a community site, it doesn't necessarily make sense to try to, you know, build a website that's the absolute best photo sharing service and the absolute best blogging service and the absolute best this and that and that. It may make sense to try to leverage the tools that are provided by all of these other open web APIs and provide a really compelling sort of combination rather than trying to build everything from scratch.
But there's a risk there too, isn't there? I mean, if somebody comes along and builds like the Flickr killer next version of Flickr, and people can just migrate their data easily to that new service, I mean, isn't that a risk for Flickr?
Yeah,
I think in the past that it, you know, there was surprising when people started opening their APIs for specifically that reason. I mean, it's just been business in the past has been nervous about allowing such sort of free flowing kinds of data like that. I mean, you know, there's this sort of belief that controlling the data is controlling the money and controlling the users. And but I think that we're really seeing things kind of start to migrate away from that, which is really, really cool. So Amazon is also really sort of famous for having APIs that are really easy to use. And so here again, actually, Matt Westgate from Lullabot created a website called CoverLover, CoverLover.com, which basically uses the Amazon APIs to get album artwork. So if, for instance, you had some need to get album artwork or book cover artwork or, movie DVD artwork, for stuff, you can just go in, and it's a Drupal site, and you go in and it uses the Amazon APIs to get the covers and then just display them there, and you can download the covers. And
ooh, I just retrieved a cover for an Elvis Costello song.
and there isn't, like, you know, from Amazon's standpoint, like, they open the APIs like that, they don't know what people are going to use them for. You know, they're hitting their servers. They've invested all this money into scanning all these covers and they assume it will lead to sales on Amazon.com, but, you know, it might just lead to people downloading the cover artwork. It is sort of a leap of faith, but on the other hand, you know, my reaction has been like, oh, well, I use Amazon because they're, it's easy to kind of get to their stuff. It's very free flowing. And in the end, I find that I end up on Amazon buying things.
Well, a good example for this is around 2006 or so, a site called Zoomer, Z-O-O-O-M-R, launched. I had to count through those O's very carefully. But the idea was it was supposed to be a Flickr killer. And they even had stuff like, you know, one button import of all of your Flickr photos, and it would just suck them over and, you know, put them onto a new Zoomer account. And there was a lot of buzz at the time over whether or not, you know, Flickr's open API approach had essentially doomed them, you know, to be eaten alive by the first company that, like, took advantage of that. And as it turns out, you know, that didn't kill Flickr. I mean, Flickr continued to thrive because a lot of the features that they had baked in, things like communities and the ability to comment back and forth on photos and the ability to, you know, set up your friends and all of the existing tools that had been built on top of their API that assumed, oh, you're going to be using Flickr and you want to be using it and that's where you store your photos. Although technically it was easy to pull all of your data out and you didn't feel like you were locked in, the fact that there was this huge built-up cloud of convenience around Flickr actually protected them from that. And, I mean, there's some people who think that even though their APIs made them seem more vulnerable, the fact that they ended up building up a whole cloud of support stuff that other people went out and wrote for them actually ended up making them a lot stronger against incoming competitors.
Yeah, yeah, it's all fascinating, really. So then you get some of the newer, social network bubble up things that sort of have different takes on how they want to do their APIs and stuff like that. Does anybody know sort of like where Facebook sits in with all this?
I feel like I'm being baited.
Hit me, James.
Yeah. So, I mean, so yeah. So Facebook has a lot of APIs, particularly around, you know, for their application developers. And I think one of, you know, so without sort of veering this podcast off topic, you know, there's a lot of sort of debate and discussion about what is, you know, how the web really should work. And it sort of stems from this, you know, this kind of fear of, you know, well, if I make all my data available, what if people don't love me anymore and they go build their own things instead? And it is, you know, I mean, and a lot of this sort of idea and this way of working is still new enough that, you know, I don't know that anybody can say for sure what will necessarily happen. And, you know, I mean, why didn't Zoomer kill Flickr and, you know, and all these kinds of things. But Facebook has some interesting constraints around the use of their API, like, you know, both in, you know, what they expose, what they allow you to do via the API. And then, one of the things that I don't think we've mentioned yet, which is also very important when doing, when looking at this kind of stuff, is the terms of service around their API, like what you're allowed to do, what you're allowed to use the data that you can get out, for and things like that. And so Facebook is sort of on the more restrictive end in those regards, as opposed to, you know, I mean, something like Flickr has they do have terms of service, but it's very sort of
laissez-faire.
It's much looser. You have much more control, much more freedom in what you do with the data you get from Flickr than what you do from say Facebook. But it's all, you know, I mean, it's one of those things where it's, you know, it's up to the service who's, you know, giving access to the data. Currently it's up to that service what they want to do. And the debate mostly, comes in when it's something like Facebook where, you know, all my information that I've put on Facebook and all of my friends that I've said are my friends on Facebook and all of my photos that I put on Facebook, although I don't think I've actually put photos on Facebook, but had I, you know, I mean, those are all sort of my photos, my friends, my information. And then, you know, the debate comes in, is it really, you know, is it really okay that Flickr or that, that Facebook then says, well, you can't actually get that information back out, or we're going to restrict the way you can get that information back out. So, yeah, it's sort of a lot of debates, but, you know, from a developer's perspective, or if you're looking to use these things, it's, you know, it's important to check, you know, what sort of the restrictions, if any, are placed on what you do with, you know, with the data. So in addition to just, you know, reading the documentation and understanding how to sort of program against the API, also understanding sort of any legal implications or things like that about it. So,
and so Open Social has been sort of a not necessarily a reaction, but another solution for some of these, you know, sort of open, coming up with an open protocol, or, you know, sort of a protocol for exchanging some of the data that you might want to get out of a website like Facebook, right? I mean, because you need a standard way of talking about things like who my friends are, or in with Facebook, you have these sort of web application kinds of things. And Facebook is building its own API for their web apps, or for their, do they call them applications? Facebook applications, these sort of widgety kinds of things that you can put on your page. But Facebook has kind of created their own API. And then I guess relatively recently they've tried to sort of open that up and say, hey, maybe everybody could use this. And people are saying,
Yeah. So, well, yeah, with Open Social, again, you touch on another thing. So it's, so right now what we're seeing a lot is, you know, Flickr and Facebook, and, you know, they have different sort of controls over it. But in both cases, they have sort of APIs that are very unique to their service, right? Like, you use the Flickr API, you know, to interact with Flickr, but the Flickr, you know, the way you interact with Flickr would be different than the way you interact with, you know, with another photo sharing site, or it's different than, you know, the way you get your photos out of Flickr is different than how you get your photos out of Facebook. And so there's a lot of sort of movements, organizations, groups of people looking at ways to sort of standardize a bunch of it. And that's another sort of exciting and very much an emerging sort of ideas, you know, things like Open Social. There's another project that I currently fancy called DIZO, which is for distributed social networks, which is, again, looking at, you know, using sort of standardized protocols for doing, you know, certain tasks, like, so, you know, having, rather than everybody using Twitter's API to post information and get status information out of Twitter, having a general sort of status getting and setting API that could be used across several sites and things like that.
That's actually a really cool thing, because James and I, in being like Twittery API junkies, actually spent some time a while back just trying to figure out, okay, so if we were to tie Drupal into all of these different services like Jaiku and Twitter that allow that kind of stuff, how would we provide some sort of standard front end to it? And those kinds of efforts in the web community to consolidate those APIs and provide sort of a standard way of talking about certain actions can really make a big difference for those things taking off.
Yeah.
So there was for some time some criticism of YouTube for not having not opening up their data, not having open APIs. So for instance, you can't get a podcast feed, an RSS enclosure feed of, I don't know, the newest, or most popular videos on YouTube. And I know recently there's been some talk about, ooh, YouTube has opened their APIs, or they have new APIs now. And so I'm sort of like wondering, like, what is YouTube done? But more like, what, when people talk about open APIs, what are they talking about? What's the difference between open APIs and not open APIs?
Well, I think generally part of that idea is an API is open if you could use it to go somewhere else. I mean, at a base level. And that's sort of like one of the reasons that there was such heated debate around some of the stuff that Facebook did. Although they had provided ways to access some of their data, it wasn't really enough that you would be able to say, find the list of all of your friends and go to another service and populate, you know, your friends over there with your friends from Facebook. And, you know, while some of that was technical and some of it was related to the terms of service about how you were allowed to use the data and stuff like that, it formed a barrier. You could do some stuff with it, but you didn't really feel like it was your information. You were still getting a little sort of keyhole view into a pile of data that they still had control of. That's like sort of the ideological answer. YouTube is starting to hit the point where I think with the new APIs that they've launched, it's effectively open. You can do things like uploading videos programmatically and pulling them down via full API requests rather than trying to copy and paste embed codes and things like that. Like there's a Drupal module that just came out that I believe, I'm not sure if it's there yet, but the goal was basically to be able to post a video on a Drupal site, but in the background it uploads it to YouTube and has them do all the compression and storage and stuff like that. And that's sort of that ideal of open APIs, the ability to transparently use this stuff and sort of move from one tool to another without having to know, oh, I'm using Facebook or I'm using YouTube or whatever.
So to some
extent, am I lying, James? Would you say that I'm just completely full of crap?
No, yes, in general. But I think just sort of try to recap. Yeah, I mean, generally the open versus not distinction comes around, you know, how much control users are given over their data, right? And where that sort of ownership line is drawn. And it's sort of a uniquely, it's an issue that's sort of uniquely bent towards the more user generated stuff, like Yahoo's stock information. You know, I mean, that's, you know, their stock information is not user generated content. I didn't upload today's Apple stock or something like that. So that's, you know, like you were saying earlier, Jeff, you know, that's information. They've made an investment to sort of,
keep it current.
Pile that data and keep it current and keep it up to date. And so that's sort of a difference. So the openness generally comes in and around, you know, the usage privileges and you know, how sort of freely the data can move.
So let's try and sort of funnel this back into Drupal land. I'm guessing that people listening are thinking, yeah, but what does this have to do with Drupal? One question I've got is, at the last DrupalCon, Dries Boitart, the project lead for Drupal, in his keynote, talked a lot about RDF. Is RDF sort of part of all of this? Is RDF part of Drupal?
Yeah. Well, RDF is actually one of those many formats that you can get data back in from some web APIs. RDF is just a way of storing certain kinds of information. It stands for, I think, Resource Description Format, which is
framework,
one of those framework. It's one of those deliciously abstract, could mean anything kind of acronyms. But basically, it's a way of exchanging just chunks of information in a standard way so that your program could be written to pull in RDF data from like 80 bajillion sources, and there would be enough information in there that it could make a stab at consolidating them or pulling them together or treating them intelligently as a big pool of data. Whereas if you were dealing with, say, you know, RSS feeds or, you know, just custom XML packets from different sources, it may take a lot more work to sort of consolidate those into a similar data format. You do on top of that is still, that's the work of programmers and the magic of, you know, programming and code and geekiness, but it's a way to standardize that data exchange.
Is that the same as like microformats? I know microformats are a way of sort of marking up things in standard ways so that you can. I mean, I guess microformats are sort of a like new age screen scraping, aren't they?
There's sort of two main components that we're talking here, or two different things. There's how you get the data. So things like, like REST versus, RPC and things like that are how you actually interact and what protocol, you use to sort of exchange the information. And then there's the format that information comes in, right? So there's RSS, and depending on the version you're using, RSS is actually, an RDF based language.
Oh, okay.
So although not the version that Drupal Core uses, but yeah, so RDF is it's an XML based format for describing, for making statements actually. They're triples of subject, predicate, object. It can get very confusing. But the nice thing about something like RDF is it's a very generalized framework where you can express all kinds of things in this common format. So what Eaton was just saying about how, if you pull a bunch of different information from various sources, but it's all represented in this standard RDF format, then you can do things like sort of merge that information together and stuff.
An example would be like representing relationships with other people. The subject predicate, that triple format that you were talking about could store things like Bob is a friend of Mary, or John is Bob's father, or things like that. And if in the wonderful, magical, standard world, if everyone used those kinds of RDF triples to express data, things like, well, I'll use my Flickr friends and my Facebook friends and the people that I've got in my Google contact list and stuff like that, and I'll just spin them together into a big list of the people that I know. And exchanging them in those kinds of triples makes it easier for a computer to go in and figure out not just here's a chunk of data, but what is that piece of data and what does it actually mean?
So again, we're talking about with all of these things, we're talking about taking data from websites on the internet and combining it together and presenting it on your website in your own unique ways. This is a mashup. This is using the APIs and combining things.
Bingo. Yeah. So yeah, it would be, taking in, or also, you can also push out too with a lot of APIs is another sort of idea that we discussed. But yeah, in a mashup, you're generally pulling from multiple data sources and creating something new out of, taking information from one source and another source and blending that information to have something new. So taking, event data from one information and photos from another thing and showing, here's all the photos from these events and things.
The question I have is how does Drupal fare with all of this?
Yeah,
I mean, this is well and good, and it's good for people who are doing Drupal work to sort of understand how this stuff happens, but how does Drupal do? I mean, when it comes to this kind of stuff, I've seen a couple of, a year or so, maybe a year and a half ago, Zach Rosen did a really cool mashup video demo, but then I haven't really seen a whole lot of other kind of examples like that since then. How is Drupal in terms of creating these kind of mashups?
Yeah, so there's you brought up the whole sort of the RDF sort of forward looking thing, but I think one of the really exciting things is all of the work with, integrating these external APIs and sort of doing this kind of work. It turns out, I think, and I know at least Jeff Eaton will agree, that Drupal is actually today sort of a really great tool for doing this kind of stuff. And there's already, a lot of support for a lot of these external APIs and ways that, in your Drupal site, you can already bring in, photos from Flickr and posts from Twitter and all that kind of stuff.
Books from Amazon.
Books from Amazon, yeah, something that Jeff Eaton can speak about. There's some things built into Drupal already, and a lot of modules then being built on top of it. So
to some extent, Drupal's modular, the way that it approaches add-on modules and plugins, has made it a really good match for a lot of these systems, because a module that you drop in doesn't just necessarily add another page on the website or something like that. It can do things like add extra data to note content nodes that you post, or expose additional head tags inside of the HTML itself that you don't even see, but that other web service aware programs can discover information about your website. The ability to tap in at different points of the page construction process and to treat the internals of Drupal as a nice system, that gives lots of places to click on those additional third-party APIs, and Drupal's module system is really good at leveraging that.
So let's say that let's come up with a quick mashup that maybe you could do in Drupal. Let's say you wanted to have all of your, you had a directory of some kind, and each of those directories had, a directory of some kind, and each of those entries you wanted to be able to show a Google map of all of the, let's say it's doctors in your city. How would you do that in Drupal these days?
Well, you would probably use, one of the location modules. I haven't used them personally, but I know Angie and a couple other people have. And this is actually a pretty common pattern for integrating APIs with Drupal. The way they work is, first, they expose access to the Google Maps APIs. So if you're writing a Drupal module, you could make a request, just by calling another Drupal function, to go out and get me a Google Map picture that includes these five geographical points. That's just at the basic level. On top of that, though, there's modules that would do things like, well, I want to be able to attach a geographical location to any node. So first, you have this one piece that just lets you say, okay, this node lives at a particular latitude and longitude or a particular street address. Then you've got this piece that lets you retrieve a map from Google. And then when you wire them together, say with something like views or a custom module, and I think the location module actually comes with all of those different pieces ready to use, or at least it did in version 5. I know it's being ported to 6 right now. But the idea is then you're combining content with location information attached to it. A Google web service that can get you a map of things, given a bunch of locations, and then you can present it in a form that shows, say, clickable icons on a map for each one of the pieces of content that you have. And that's just at a real simple level. All of those pieces sort of coming together and meeting to make your website more powerful. And you don't have to do things like go out and write code to, calculate distances between things and place things on a map accurately. That's what Google will handle. That's like what a lot of mashups have done with, say Flickr, because people can put location data on their Flickr pictures. But inside of Drupal, you could put location data on any kind of content and then leverage it in that way.
There's the whole location-based stuff is really, really interesting. It's just, especially with the new iPhone coming out, there's a lot of talk about, ooh, everybody's got GPS and you've got a great, great browser now and all this kind of stuff. And so I really think that sort of the location-based stuff is a really exciting area, particularly around these kind of mashups, and you're getting some things like Fire Eagle and these sort of like location management systems that are starting to come up and stuff like that. And I think it's been historically actually relatively weak. There have been several sort of entries in the area in Drupal. But I don't know. It's sort of every time I do it, it seems to be sort of a new way of kind of putting together these sort of location-based things in Drupal. I actually just stumbled across a really, really cool post on groups.drupal.org/node/12485. Brandon Bergen has posted not too long ago an entry called "The State of Geospatial in Drupal," which is basically sort of talking about location-based stuff. And
that sounds so awesome in sci-fi.
And kind of what's going on. And so there's sort of a you know, you can kind of look at it there if you want to keep up. And I think there's still a bunch of work that needs to be done in this area. But I mean, certainly what I've seen is leveraging, this is a good example of like leveraging the Google Maps APIs, to just kind of do that. Like, you know, instead of kind of asking people for like, where are you located? And then trying to keep some sort of a zip code lookup table in the Drupal website. Instead, it's like, just click on the Google map where you are and Google will tell us where you are. And then we'll enter that in the data. And, there's some, interesting ways of sort of leveraging things. And I think that, sometimes, you know, in terms of usability, and that kind of stuff, there's sort of handoffs, but yeah. And Jeff, you've been doing a lot of work with like Amazon. You're kind of the API guy at this point.
Well, I think James actually was the API guy way before I was the API guy. But, you know,
thank you, Eden.
When I came into Drupal, one of the reasons was it had all these cool API things, which James had actually gone and built. But one of the first things that I started playing around with was when I moved my blog to Drupal, I wanted to be able to include pictures of the books that I was reading, like their covers. So I used Amazon module, and over time I ended up actually contributing features back to it. And in Drupal 6, I actually ended up rewriting Amazon module from scratch to take advantage of a bunch of new features in Drupal 6 and developments in the Amazon.com APIs. So that's another one of those that I'm like really stoked and passionate about, because there's so much stuff that can be leveraged. Things like whenever you enter a blog post, you can ask Amazon, here, given this 200-word chunk of text, what books do you think would be relevant? And just, you know, give me back those books so I can give people links to them and stuff like that. Those are really cool examples of how you can sort of get easy wins for making a website more content-rich and stuff like that without actually doing the heavy lifting of, say, writing an algorithm that figures out what books would be relevant.
And the cool thing, I mean, again, like, in my opinion, sort of the thing that's different from just sort of using an API and creating a mashup, I guess technically you've got Drupal and you've got, you know, an external something, Amazon or Google Maps or Flickr or whatever. And kind of when you start to bring the Amazon content in, you've mashed it into your website, into your Drupal site. But I really see it like, you know, when it really starts to get interesting is when you start taking multiple of these sort of web 2.0 websites and started to use them together. So, I mean, and leveraging them for that. So we talk about Twitter a lot. And you can follow me at JJeff is my Twitter username. And
I'm off.
What? I'm sorry. You might
be EATON on Twitter. For those who don't know,
I'm just gonna rise above it.
If you rise above, I might surpass you. And
there's not in any way a race for who can get the most followers going on.
No. Certainly, Lullabot doesn't have that going on. J J E double F. But Twitter is really cool because they provide a free. I mean, you know, you look at it, but they've got a free SMS gateway going, right? So
you can post to it from your phone, or you can get updates from selected people via your cell phone and stuff like that. It's awesome.
Assuming that Twitter is up, you could have it so that when you post a blog entry or something like that, you could have it send out SMS messages to everyone who wants to get them. You can also do private things with it and stuff like that. So, and you can... You could even potentially do sort of incoming kinds of stuff. So you could, with Twitter post, we did a Drupal meetup in Providence at the last workshops. And what was the thing you were doing? You were
posting it was a proof of concept.
PHP code that would be executed by Drupal that you would post by via your cell phone.
It was. It should never have been done.
Yeah.
Just as a concept, it was horribly evil and wrong. But it was kind of fun as a proof of concept. I mean, and obviously you would want to do it in a more secure way than, say, via Twitter. But it's an example of how you can use these kinds of open APIs to even drive events on your website. You know, like when something happens on one site, you could actually have that automatically trigger posting new content or unpublishing certain things or whatever on your own site.
You could show a web page of your Twitter updates, and maybe in your Twitter update you'd enter a zip code, or you could use some sort of location information of some type, and so it would post your Twitter updates along with a Google map of all of the places that you've updated from on your Drupal site.
This is where Cory Doctorow gets to listen.
And then maybe it would go to Flickr and show photos that were taken nearby as well.
This is kind of mashup stuff.
I'm not feeling very imaginative, but
so pictures and Twitter is, you know. Some of the stuff that doesn't get talked about a lot. I mean, things like let's say Unfuddle, which we use a lot because it gives you an SVN repository where you can store code when it's under development. It gives you bug and issue tracking stuff. It has full open APIs. So we've actually used that a couple of times. Do things like throw up a quick little sidebar block on an internal website while we're working on a project that shows what the latest 15 check-ins are so that we can see what code is being changed. You can do all of those kinds of things with lots of different services that provide web APIs, not just the super popular, you know, Flickr plus Delicious plus Amazon kind of stuff. Lots of other services are starting to provide these, and there are lots of opportunities to pull in those, you know, great tools and not reinvent the wheel.
So let's say, for instance, that we thought the podcast was going a little bit long and we wanted to start wrapping things up.
Yeah, okay. One of the things that we wanted to talk about. So yeah, there's already a ton of support for a bunch of these APIs. And so if you're browsing the modules on Drupal.org, the modules already available for download, there's a category for third-party integration. It's actually conveniently the top category. And it's got, you know, over 300 modules in it just for doing these kinds of integrations. So Drupal already has, you know, in addition to sort of Core's built-in aggregator and Core's built-in XML RPC support, stuff like that, it's also got, there's also, you know, this sort of wealth of contributed modules that are already available to integrate with most popular.
I'm just looking through this page, and already I'm coming up with better examples than what I came up with already in the podcast.
Yeah, no, it's really staggering. So, I mean, the one other thing that we wanted to talk about was Eaton and I are two people sort of prone to write some of these modules, talk about sort of some of the best practices or tips and tricks sort of things that not everybody is maybe aware of, or just sort of experiences that we've had in sort of writing one of these things. And a lot of this comes from I wrote a Twitter module a year and a bit ago in an afternoon. I think it was all of 80 lines, which is sort of the first thing that I want to stress, that, like, you know, integrating with these APIs is frequently, you know, in Drupal, thanks to the magic of Drupal's lightweight code and modular architecture, it can be very, very sort of, low impact to do some of the integration with these things. So, you know, I wrote this, a year and a bit ago, and Eaton sort of picked it up and,
did bad things, but did good things.
And so we've been, you know, sort of, you know, off and on for the last several months, going back and forth and trying to use Twitter as Drupal developers, should we be approaching these kinds of things and trying to work with these things and trying to, you know, do it effectively and efficiently from inside of Drupal. And so, yeah, so maybe that's a good topic to close with.
And we can try to be as as concise as possible. I think probably one of the biggest things that both of us have seen is web services out there provide APIs to do lots of stuff. If you're developing an integration module, as much as possible, try to provide as much access to that full API that the website exposes as much as possible, because there's a lot of functionality there. And even if your module doesn't provide a front end for it or provide a user interface for it, if you have helper functions behind the scenes that make it possible to leverage some of those API features that the external website provides, other people can build on top of your module and start adding that functionality. Even if they don't need it for the same use case you did, they can still leverage that. That's one of the biggest things, not assuming that your use case is the only one.
Yeah, and that's huge. And things like, you know, and this exists a lot. And, you know, so this is the approach with the Twitter module for Drupal 6 we've taken. But also, I mean, things like the GMAP module and stuff, because a lot of times in integrating with these external sources, you know, you need to either, you know, associate user accounts with each other, or, you know, things like Google Maps has an API key that you have to have. And so, you know, if your base module, if you're implementing somebody's API, if you implement the API functions and have a way to, you know, to set up sort of the base API key information or things like that, then other module developers won't have to, you know, if you've exposed all of the API, they can just build, you know, an alternate interface or, you know, some sort of glue to tie it into something that they're doing without having to re-implement a bunch of that or fill in the gaps with, you know, things that you hadn't implemented or try to, you know, to redo a bunch of your work.
Right. And like that's it, back in the way olden days of Drupal, there were lots of modules that did one thing, like say a module that would pull in delicious links and show them on the user profile page. Now, if you don't want to show them on the user profile page and you want to do something else with them, you need access to the underlying API. And that's the difference. Another biggie is if you're doing development for Drupal 6, use Views 2 as much as possible. Views 2 can expose any table in your database as like a first class kind of data that you could make a view of and filter it and sort it and stuff like that, make sidebar blocks out of it. If you are storing any of that external API data in the Drupal database, expose it to views and use that for your listing pages and stuff like that as much as possible. That's the approach that we ended up taking with the Twitter module, and it ended up saving us tons of work because we didn't have to write custom one-off pages. We just built view-based pages and view-based blocks, and we ended up actually getting tons and tons of functionality that we wouldn't have bothered going to the work of building from scratch because views just let us do it automatically. Things like show me the last 5 Twitter messages by the author of the node that's currently being listed on the page. You know, bits like that. You get it for free. It's a no-brainer. And if somebody doesn't need to use views, they just turn that off and your module doesn't have the overhead of all the custom code.
Hmm. Yeah, exactly. It's really cool because, again, a lot of the things that people were, you know, trying to do in these modules was think of, okay, well, you know, Twitter information. Well, I want to show, you know, a sidebar block of every user on the site, all of their Twitter posts, or maybe I want to show one user's posts on their profile page and all these various permutations that can all, you know, the kinds of things that everybody started using views for Node and for content. The nice thing is that now in Drupal 6, you can actually use views 2 for sort of the data that you're fetching from the API. And it helps sort of solve another thing that we've wrestled with and seen people wrestle with. And that's, you know, should you be creating nodes for everything you're importing from another site? And sometimes that makes sense and sometimes it doesn't. And so one of the sort of approaches that, you know, we've taken with Twitter, as well as I know, Eaton, you've done with Amazon module, is mm-hmm. to just fetch and store the information from the external service and store it sort of independently. And then from there, you can basically give an option whether that gets integrated as a node or not. And by having views too, being able to give listings of things, it doesn't necessarily of things that aren't nodes, it doesn't necessarily have to ever become a node. You can do, you know, just a list of, you know, 3 Amazon products
right.
that aren't nodes, yeah.
Just for kicks, I made a view that did nothing but display a list of books that were written by Jane Austen. No nodes involved, no nothing. It automatically filtered on fields from Amazon, and Views 2 just let me build all of that. And the beauty is so much work previously went into thinking of all the different ways people might want to present stuff, and Views 2 helps eliminate that.
And they need to do that in Drupal 6.
Yes. If you're doing it in Drupal 5, you know, it's...
But great reason to start on that upgrade process. So can I? Okay. So I have like a secret not enough people know about internal function to Drupal that I am just.
All right, here it is, folks.
Yeah,
this is the piece of information you've been waiting for all podcast.
7 hours in, it's finally the moment you've been waiting for. Yeah, not enough people know about Drupal underscore HTTP underscore request, and. Basically, with Drupal HTTP request and now if you're using PHP 5, using simple XML to parse the XML that comes back, you can do, you know, like three lines of code and have, you know, API integration. So essentially what Drupal HTTP request is a Drupal API wrapper that just encapsulates the process of making, you know, a REST style or a web request. And it supports both GET requests and POST requests. It has all kinds of handy things like detecting redirects and things like that.
Retrying if there are timeouts.
Whoa. Retrying if there are timeouts. Yeah, it cuts down a lot of, you know, and I'll look at some other code and, you know, other systems and plugins for other systems. And, you know, I'm always reminded and feel grateful for Drupal request and how much of that sort of process gets encapsulated for us. So, definitely one of my favorite lesser known, API functions for Drupal, Drupal internal API function.
And PHP 5 makes it a lot easier to parse XML. Right?
Yeah, that's the simple XML thing that he mentioned. It's built in, and one of the nice things, again, about Drupal 6 is that if your module is really dependent on the simple XML functions in PHP 5, in your modules.info file, you can say that it requires PHP 5. And that means that you don't have to deal with telling everybody, no, that's why it's breaking, because you don't have PHP 5.
Sounds like you've had to do that before, Jeff.
Just a tad. I mean, yeah. An example is the Drupal 5 version of the Amazon Tools module had all of its own XML parsing code. In the Drupal 6 version of the Amazon module, it uses simple XML built into PHP 5. That eliminated roughly 60K of code.
And Drupal 6 doesn't require PHP 5. It can work on PHP 4 as well. But Drupal 7... will require PHP 5.
The big difference is your module can tell Drupal it requires.
Oh, okay. So in Drupal 5, it couldn't say.
Right.
Got it.
He just had it breaking, and people asked why.
Cool. All right. Any last thoughts?
If you're looking for additional examples of great web APIs and stuff that's out there, programmableweb.com is a great resource. It's a huge archive of all of the websites out there that expose APIs. What is it, hundreds, thousands? Huge number. And if you're looking for a great third-party tool to integrate with to solve a particular need, you can browse through it by what the sites do and what they offer and, you know, get cracking. And also, the third-party integration page on drupal.org/project/modules/category/52. Great place.
And modules has a capital M.
Yes.
You know how you're writing that down? Go back and make it a capital M now on your little napkin. We're all writing on napkins now, yes. So I think we lost John.
I think we may have lost some of our listeners.
John, I think John had an emergency with one of his children and had to run off. But
Thanks for sticking with us.
Yeah, goodness. That was quite a, you know, these things we think like, oh, that'll be simple. Just a one subject.
Talk about APIs.
Talk about APIs. And there you go. So, well, we covered a lot of stuff, and I'm sure people have a lot of comments. Please come and comment on the podcast if you have ideas or want to expand or correct us on any of these things. And if you want to follow us on Twitter.
That's Eaton, E-A-T-O-N, at Twitter.com.
And you can also follow Lullabot, L-U-L-L-A-B-O-T, on Twitter, and we post sometimes when we have important things, particularly around conferences and stuff like that. So I won't say my Twitter name again, but I will say, in the spirit of friendly competition, James Walker is Walka, W-A-L-K-A-H.
On Twitter.
But don't follow also, him. Do not follow also, him. Follow me.
Also, he's winning substantially.
Well, that's why I'm playing dirty. Yeah. So. All right. There you go. Podcast 61. See you next time. Bye-bye.
Later.